Welcome again, Mr. Krupp. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure, Daphne. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. Chinese President Xi Jinping, now he has a new term, new team, and new polity. What is your latest assessment on U.S.-China policy while he's gaining more political power and financial control?
Well, you're absolutely right, Daphne. Mm-hmm. I mean, now he has literally unlimited power and boundless ambition. I don't think there's been a dictator in the world who's had this much power since 1945. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that you're seeing right now is a crackdown on the private sector, particularly taking over the tech companies and the finance companies. And companies in the U.S. are taking note of that right now. And, you know, if you look at where he's going with this, I think he feels a sense of mortality, a sense of urgency, you know, with the demographics, how that will be changing over the years. Mm-hmm. And he is hell-bent for global domination. And what he's doing now is he's exporting dictator out of the box.
The Biden administration just issued this new national security strategy, and one of these goals is to outcompete China. In your opinion, what is our best strategy to compete with China?
Well, we not only need to outcompete, but we have to defeat what they're trying to do. And, you know, I was asked the question in my Senate confirmation hearing, what would be my strategy to combat China's aggression? And I said I would harness the free world's three biggest advantages by unifying and rallying our allies and our friends, number one. Number two, leveraging the innovation and the resources of the private sector. And number three, amplifying the moral high ground of trust principles. So, you know, if you look at, you know, my mission was to develop and operationalize a global economic security strategy to drive economic growth, maximize national security, and also to combat that aggression. And so we had three pillars. The first one is, I would call it offense. So that is turbocharge, economic competitiveness, and also innovation. The second is the safeguard assets, things like intellectual property, financial systems, supply chains, those kind of things. And the third one was to build a network of trusted partnerships. So these were the things that we executed over the last few years. And indeed, those are the things that we're putting together now in the Global Tech Security Commission.
Okay. Next, Ms. Krupp, I want to have your take on the quote from Congressman Mike Gallagher, the chairman of the new House Select Committee on the Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party. He said that in his opening statement of a very important hearing, he said, "We call it a strategic competition, but it is not a polite tennis match. This is a existential struggle over what type of world we want to live in. Do we want to live in an Orwellian world of total totalitarian technology control? We must act with a sense of urgency. I believe our policy over the next 10 years will set the stage for the next 100.
Mike's absolutely right. You know what it is an epic contest of freedom versus authoritarianism, because the reality we face as a free world is seemingly ceaseless, intense variations of techno-economic competition. And what we see China doing is playing a four-dimensional game of military, economic, diplomatic, and cultural chess. And technology is at the crossroads. That's kind of the main battleground. And what we see, the way they're playing, is with little respect for rule of law, for property of all kinds, for sovereignty of nations, for the environment, for human rights, for the press. And I think the world, citizens of the world are now really waking up to that. And, you know, I believe in the free market and free enterprise. But when somebody comes in the market and doesn't play by the rules, the market's no longer free. It's a fool's market. So you have to do something about it.
Okay. The committee also starts a two-year drive to decouple with China. But Mr. Krupp, U.S.-China trade also hit a record last year, 2022. How can we decouple with China strategically?
Well, that is the way to do it, is strategically. So if you look at where that crossroads is, it's really technology is the most important thing. because, you know, the average American citizen or citizens all over the world are unknowingly financing China's surveillance state that enables the genocide that's going on in Xinjiang. They're unknowingly financing China's military buildup. And so these are the things that, and that's why the China Select Committee is so important, is that we've got to educate everybody in the world because, you know, the Chinese Communist Party has been trying to suppress that for so long. Conflicts of interest, all their intense lobbying, all of that. And so what you're doing here is such an important thing. And I always thank the members of the press because, you know, the best disinfectant is transparency. And
tell the truth.
Yeah, to tell the truth.
I interviewed Secretary Pompeo yesterday. He said the world, it's nutty for the world still let China to operate within the WHO as a developing country. Do you think we should change the most favored nation status for China?
I think it's a no-brainer, so I agree with Mike. And if you think about it, you know, by law, they should not have a most favored nation status because just the fact alone, they are committing punishable genocide. So what are those consequences? And, you know, there's no way that they should do it because they also don't play by the rules. So Daphne, may pretend you're a Silicon Valley CEO and I'm a Chinese company. So if I'm competing against you and I could steal your intellectual property, I don't have to be transparent. I don't have to be reciprocal with my market. I can use forced labor that they export all over China. I can use these big unregulated coal-fired power plants. I don't have to obey the law or end the law. That's it. I'm going to beat you every time. And you've got to do something about it.
Mr. Kroc, the committee that we just talked about also shine a spotlight on another issue that you have focused on to alert U.S. investors to unknowingly financing China's military buildup. You, as a former undersecretary, you have published several fact sheets exposing thousands of malign Chinese companies.
Yes.
And it seems like the Biden administration is following your lead.
You know,
what else can we do?
They've institutionalized what we did in terms of capital market sanctions. Matter of fact, the Biden administration has carried on all our strategies, all our policies, from the Clean Network to the Economic Prosperity Partnership in Taiwan, everything we did with technology. So when you look at it from a capital market standpoint, there's a number of things that need to be done. The first one is if you look at capital market sanctions, it should be on three companies: Tencent, Alibaba, and Baidu. Why? Because these three companies are the biggest enablers, the most important companies for Chinese military AI program. And they're also, right after Huawei, 2, 3, and 4, for perpetuating the surveillance state. The other thing that needs to be done in this financial area is if you look at ESG, environment, social, and governance. Those funds have grown from $17 billion 15 years ago to about $40 trillion. And so you look at all these Chinese companies that are in it, and the question is, should any of those Chinese companies be in ESG? Because if you think it, and we did a case study on this
at Wharton. Yeah, Wharton Business School.
Yes, at Wharton Business School. And it lays out the students, well, there's three reasons why they shouldn't be. First one is E, the environment, the biggest polluters in the world.
Right.
And this case was on solar panels, and they're made with the two biggest coal-fired power plants in the world, and they're unregulated. The second is social. So what's important about social? It's human rights.
Right.
Well, these guys are committing genocide. They're shipping the slave labor everywhere. And then the third one is governance.
G.
And so you think about that, that's the fiduciary duty. And these companies are not transparent and they can't be audited. So that's a big aspect in terms of ESG. The other thing is, I really believe this is really important, that the Secretary of Labor should put out a business advisory, just as we put out a business advisory on slave labor. He should put one out to all the pension fund managers because he has two-thirds of the authority in the United States government for ERISA. ERISA is all the different pension funds, $11.7 trillion worth of pension funds, because there's Chinese stock spirit in there everywhere. Mm.
You are also considered the architect of the CHIPS and Science Act. What are your thoughts on the U.S.-China chip war? How critical is this industry to countering the economic and the technological threat from China?
Yes. Well, there's no doubt about it, Daphne, that semiconductor is the most important industry in the world. It underlies anything with an on and off switch, right?
Right.
And in 2020, there was not one company that was going to build any semiconductor plants in the United States. And that's when we onshored the most important company to United States national security, most important foreign company, is Taiwan Semiconductor, the biggest onshoring in history. And since that time, that's been a catalyst, $350 billion of investment in the U.S. and jobs have taken place, either announced or committed to. And that was also the catalyst that we used to write the CHIPS and Science Act, which is huge. And it also includes $200 billion in R&D funding, which the analogy I always use, it's like the Apollo program, which really led to leadership in areas like microelectronics, software, aerospace, all those kind of things.
Okay, let's talk about Huawei, because former U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster said that the China Network Alliance of Democracy you built as the Undersecretary of State to counter Huawei's march to dominance in 5G was the first government initiative that defeated the China Inc. Imminent ban on U.S. export to Huawei is seen as a new wave of restrictions that will impair China's semiconductor, AI, and quantum computing industries, all the criticals for tech dominance in military and commercial realms. Why is Huawei a red flag for the United States?
Well, if you think about Huawei, they're China's most important company. They're the backbone for that surveillance state. That enables them to export the dictator out of the box. So it was critical at that point. And if you remember a few years ago, both sides of the aisle were hitting the panic button. It looked like Huawei was going to run the tables. And then in March 2020, we got the authorities. And basically what we did is we did that strategy that I talked about in the Senate confirmation hearing. We built the Clean Network Alliance of Democracy. So in less than 9 months, we put on those 60 countries, two-thirds of the world's global GDP, 200 telcos. And what that did is that provided a security blanket against China's retaliation, which everybody was fearing. And it came down to one thing and one thing only, and that is trust. Because the thing that I found out my first 60 bilaterals as undersecretary, when I talked to my foreign counterparts, economic ministers, finance ministers, and being a bilateral, I say, how's your relationship with China? They go, well, they're a very important trading partner. And it seemed like every time, Daphne, they looked both ways and go, but we don't trust them.
Okay.
And that rang bells in my head because just a year before, I'm standing up in front of our DocuSign employees. And I go, we're not in the software business. We're in the trust business. We deal with people's most important documents. Those are the ones you sign. And that is the most important word in any language. You do business with people you trust. You partner with people you trust. You buy from people you trust. And nobody seems to trust China.
Mr. Kraut, you were the most senior diplomat to visit Taiwan, and Taiwan's de facto ambassador, Xiao Meiqing, was Taiwan's number one friend. We know that Taiwan's been in the headlines recently because after Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And the Wall Street Journal also reported that U.S. is sending more troops to Taiwan, and it said that President Tsai Ing-wen could also visit the United States this year.
Yes.
Do you think what can we do to deter Xi Jinping's ambition to take over Taiwan, while so many experts predict that POA can take Taiwan by the year 2027?
Yes. I'd say it was one of the great honors of my life, Daphne, to go to Taiwan on that mission. And, you know, when you look at Taiwan, they are a role model democracy. They're a beacon of freedom. To General Secretary Xi, they dispel his myth that the Chinese culture, can only live under authoritarian rule. And he wants to take it over. And if he does, he's going to treat the Taiwanese people like he treats the people in Xinjiang. Mm-hmm,
yes.
And that, it, to me, that's scary. So in our six-pronged strategy, mm-hmm. The key part was to tighten the ties with Taiwan. We did that with the Economic Prosperity Partnership, which is one of the broadest partnerships that we have. We did a science and tech agreement. We did that onshoring with TSMC. Mm-hmm. And we also set it up for a trade agreement. And the key thing is, mm-hmm. is that when the United States has that kind of a relationship with a country, then private sector investment follows. U.S. private sector investment follows. And when that happens, the allies invest. And we want U.S. and our allies to invest in Taiwan. Because mm-hmm. if Putin decides to do something with Taiwan, we want all our friends by our side, because right. there's strength in numbers and there's power in unity and solidarity.
In addition to the alliance and the military side support, as a part of your mission to counter China's potential invasion, you also designed a special strategy to deter Beijing's aggression by creating an economic security blanket
yes.
around Taiwan. Can you please explain this special strategy to us as well?
Yeah, and that is, mm-hmm. It's all around private sector mm-hmm. Investment, and it's all around tightening those ties. And that, you know, that's probably one of the most key things, because if you have something at stake from a financial standpoint,
right.
you're gonna be there to protect it. And you know, the other thing is that Taiwan's just been a great friend mm-hmm. to the United States. I mean, I've been going there for so many years, and boy, you talk about courageous. And what was interesting is when Putin his bloody invasion, unprovoked invasion. Of the Ukraine, and the Ukrainian people courageously stood up, and then the world united around them. That really, I think that was a key moment for Taiwan, because mm-hmm. I think she's looking at that and going, oh my God, if I try to do something with Taiwan, then he's just united a free world again, mm-hmm. and double down.
There's a term, I don't know, have you heard it or not, it's Silicon Shield of Taiwan, of the TSMC. Is that similar to your idea about the economic blankets of security of mm-hmm. Taiwan? Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Taiwan, mm-hmm. this is home of the manufacturing of the world's most advanced semiconductors. Mm. So, and by the way, this is a big reason why she wants to take it, right. because mm-hmm. he's absolutely obsessed with semiconductors. He's been trying to catch United States, Taiwan, for years, mm-hmm. and he just can't. So, you know, this is something that the Taiwanese people are so proud of. And, you know, Morris Chang, founder of TSMC, he's such a good friend. I call him the Oracle. So that is a real strategic asset for Taiwan.
Besides Taiwan, Mr. Kroc, you also had been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, for your campaign against the CCP. In your opinion, what can we do more to support not only Taiwan, but also like Hong Kong, Tibet, and Xinjiang?
Yes, because that is so important to do. And, you know, if you look at what was behind that, mm-hmm. that was this trust doctrine. And that is the thing that unites us. And that is, you know, the respect for sovereignty of nations, for rule of law, all those kind of the environment, human rights. And so it is all about strength in terms of unity. Because if there's anything that General Secretary Xi fears is United States. Mm-hmm. There's one thing maybe even more than that, and mm-hmm. that is a united free world. And that is key. And I'll tell you, it's so refreshing these days to see this whole Chinese Communist Party issue is the biggest unifying issue on Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, Mr. Kroc, that countering the threat from China, especially the economic, technological side, has become a bipartisan consensus right now. If I may have your take on another quote from Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy.
Yes. By the way, he's on our commission. He's one of...
Really? I didn't know about
he's
that.
He's an honorary co-chairman.
He's also in the select committee.
Yes, of course.
Yes. And then he said, for the past 30 years, both Democrats and Republicans have underestimated the CCP, believing that trade and investment with China will ultimately bring democracy and greater security to the Indo-Pacific region, which in fact, the opposite has happened. In your opinion, why the policy like trade for change has been a failure over the past decades?
Well, I think it's been over the last several decades. And I think it was, I think all of us, we really believe that capitalism would equal democracy.
We'll make a change.
And we were all fooled. So now it's time to take off those rose-colored glasses and not treat China how we hope they'd be, but how they truly are. And, you know, I am a lover of China, the Chinese people. I've been going there since 1981. I love the culture. I love the history. Of course, the food. So when I talk, I'm not talking about the 1.2 billion Chinese people that are not part of the elite Chinese Communist Party. And when I think about the suppression that they live under, the surveillance state that they live under, you know, you don't see like people trying to immigrate into China, right? How this has been ramped up. So it's time that we really got to do something about it. Because last I checked, General Secretary Xi's not slowing down anytime soon.
Well, Xi is like, you know, strengthening his control. Former U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger, he made a suggestion. I want to have your take on that as well. He called on the United States government to cooperate with the U.S. technology companies banned by China to help Chinese people bypass the strict network censorship mechanism. I quote it here. He said, "I think you could punch holes in the great Chinese firewall," said Matt Pottinger. Do you think it's a good idea?
By the way, Matt's a great friend. We worked arm in arm in the administration. Absolutely. And I think, you know, if you look at the great, I call it the great one-way China firewall.
Yes.
It's where all the data comes in for China's own use, but none goes out. And then reciprocally, all the propaganda goes out, but the truth does not come in. By the way, thank God for Voice of America to hopefully penetrate. But we want to do more. And you know what? Our most important ally are the technology companies. And that's what I meant when I said leverage the innovation resources of the private sector. And when I was undersecretary, I hosted 36 of the top Silicon Valley CEOs in my home in San Francisco.
Yes.
And you know, it was an amazing experience because, you know, most of these guys have been there, safe environment. And I had them go around the room and tell their China horror stories.
Yes, you just remind me, you're from Silicon Valley. Do you know any specific company can help, you know, this idea to punch the holes in the great Chinese firewall?
I absolutely do. Some of it's classified. Obviously, we were working on that, right? But absolutely. Yeah, because the technology exists out there.
Mr. Kroc, you recently co-founded the Kroc Institute for Tech Diplomacy at Purdue, America's top national security university. This seems like the continuation of your work building the Clean Network Alliance of Democracies. What is tech diplomacy, and how can the free world keep technology safe from authoritarian threats?
Sure. So the Kroc Institute for Tech Diplomacy, our North Star, is that technology must advance freedom. It could be used for good or bad. Now, tech diplomacy and the thing that goes with it, tech statecraft, is the integration of high-tech strategies, these things we learned in the business world, with foreign policy tools based on this trust doctrine. And it's the thing that we have been doing is we've been training diplomats here, training diplomats around the world in this whole area of tech diplomacy, because a lot of this stuff, they don't teach at the State Department, the Commerce Department, the Treasury, DOD, anything like that. By the way, we're also training the private sector in this area as well, and as well as running the Global Tech Security Commission.
To address the growing technological threats from the CCP, I know that, Ms. Crocker, you also launched a new commission called Global Tech Security Commission this week in Washington, D.C. And I learned that Taiwan government also part of this commission.
Can you tell us more about it? We have the Minister of Technology. You know, this is a uniquely strategic commission because, first of all, it's international. So there's 15 countries, including including Taiwan. Each one has a commissioner, and then it includes all 12 national tech security sectors, and there's a commissioner for each one of those. For example, space is one of those. Dr. Dan Gold, longest-serving director of NASA, is that commissioner. And then there's 20 strategy commissioners who are specialists in things like venture capital, investment screening, export controls, those kind of things. And they each have advisory council of 6 to 10 people. So now you're talking about 400 of the world's top experts. And the objective of the game is to develop the global tech security strategy for the free world. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, it's not like a lot of the other commissioners were just pointing out, you know, here's the problem, here's how we defend against it. This is coming up with offensive and defensive strategies, and also for force multipliers. And the objective is to build a global trust network that lives by tech standards to drive the adoption of trusted technology. That's the metric at the end of the day, Daphne.
Maybe the final thought as a conclusion of our discussion today, with the world more vigilant, U.S. and the world more vigilant about the economic and technological threat from China, and China also has its own internal problem, like population problem. You know, do you think China can still be the world's largest economy, can still be the number one as they wanted to? Who is winning, East or West, United States or China? Your idea.
Well, you know, if you look at what's going on now in China, with Xi taking over the companies, suppressing the people, what's going on in the real estate business, the COVID lockdowns, you know, people aren't happy. I think the Chinese citizens have lost that pact with General Secretary Xi, that as long as the economy continues to grow, then you can do whatever you want. And I think the Chinese people have really caught on, too. I mean, I've talked to a lot of my friends, and it's like, you know, we're really tired of this stuff. Mm-hmm. So the question is, you know, she's running against the clock on a lot of things, on the demographics. But the big thing is, the world has woken up. And and I think that's what China was trying to avoid all along, a Pearl Harbor, a 9/11. I think when COVID hit and they ramped up their aggression, and we saw it everywhere, right? We saw the co-option of Hong Kong, eviscerate the citizens' freedom, the cover-up of the virus, creating a pandemic. By the way, there's no I was responsible for infectious diseases at the State Department. There's no doubt in my mind, all roads lead to Wuhan, and the emperor has no clothes on this. By the way, he should be guilty until proven innocent, because he's not letting any of us in there. And I think people have realized that. And now you see people, they've learned that coercion in Xinjiang has turned into punishable genocide. And they don't like it.
Thank you so much, Ms. Kruk. So many things that we can think about, you know, for this interview with you today. My pleasure talking to you, as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Daphne. Thank you.